Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Hello and welcome to MTG Pro Tutor. This is episode 94. 100 is fast approaching. Can you believe it? This has been an incredible journey. I love doing it. I'm super excited to do 100 plus more. So this is great. Today, we have an amazing guest, Ari Lax, who has a mind that is just immersive and incredible. And I'm so excited to sit down and talk to him. But first, I do want to say congratulations to Javier Prowl. He won the patron exclusive giveaway for April. He has a Shadows of Innistrad backpack headed his way. So Javier, if you're listening, thank you so much. Congratulations. And everybody else, if you want in on this action, if you want to be considered for the monthly giveaway that we do, then go to mtgprotutor.com/Patreon and you can sign up there. There's different levels. You can support the show directly. And it doesn't matter what level that you support at, you can definitely be considered for these drawings. And the higher levels you get, you're going to get sweet things like custom tokens and just a whole bunch of fun stuff that I have set up for you. So mtgprotutor.com/Patreon to check that out. And again, the April giveaway of a Shadows over Innistrad Fat Pack is going to Javier Prowl. So congratulations. Did you catch Grand Prix New York last weekend? I know it was Mother's Day, so if you didn't, totally get it. But long story short, Seth Manfield took it down. He won his fourth Grand Prix title. Seth is on fire. I'm really looking forward to having him on the show. I can't wait to hear all about his journey, what he does, how he does it. And it was just really cool to see, you know, the best players go at it and bring these decks that are tried and true now, and also see some innovation. Like, it's always neat to see what shakes out after a Pro Tour in the Standard realm. So that's really, really cool. Anyway, so the last thing before we dive in is I have launched a free video training series. It's at levelupyourskill.com. That's levelupyourskill.com. So just head on over there and check it out. Again, it's a free video training series compiling some of the best tips that I've gathered over all these interviews. And it covers things like sideboarding and mindset and finding a deck. And again, it's a free video training series, levelupyourskill.com. Head on over there to check it out. Well, there you have it. A lot of exciting stuff going on, but that will do it for the top of the interview stuff. So let's bring Ari in, sit down, and talk about Magic. What is up, everybody? I am super pumped to have our guest with us today. Our guest is a member of Team Ultra Pro, writes premium articles for StarCityGames.com, has 8 Grand Prix top 8s with 1 win, and is the Pro Tour Cons of Tarkir champion. Coming to us from Cambridge, let's welcome Ari Lax. Ari, how you doing today?
Pretty good. Yeah, nice Thursday evening today.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience tips and tricks to take their game to the next level?
As always, I love to talk about the game whenever I'm given the chance.
Excellent. Now, all you prodigies out there, if you want to connect with Ari, the best place to do that is on Twitter. He's at ARMLX. So really easy. Just look him up. He knows a lot about Magic, as we will all soon see, and we're ready to dive on in. So, Ari, tell us about what you got going on out there. So is Magic all you do? We mentioned in the bio that you write for Star City Games. So are you able to string together a living off of writing and playing, or do you have something else going on?
I'm also a full-time engineer for a company out here. I, as with a lot of Magic players, I write code. I think that's a pretty common activity. I think there's a lot of parallels between that and Magic, just discrete systems where you have things that occur in a set order based on text, and then that text translates to actions and numbers and all sorts of things that you kind of have this visual mathematical representation of everything that's going on that you have to keep track of.
Wow, I never, ever thought of that. That's so true. Okay, so like when you're coding, the visual representation is the program that you get when you're done. And in Magic, the visual representation is the board state and what's going on there.
Yeah, it's the visual representation is like the text. And then, things occur as the text, just like how when you attack with a creature and they block with the creature, the text and the numbers all result in something else happening.
Man, that's so neat. Awesome. So you're a coder, a writer, and obviously a player. Are you a lover as well? Married, girlfriend, do you have that going on as well? Or
Somewhere between the two. It's been 10-ish years, so.
Okay. So how do you, the reason why I ask is, how do you balance all that? Obviously, you have a career and you play Magic competitively. You wouldn't have won a Pro Tour if you weren't competitive, and then have this serious relationship. How do you balance all of that? Because that's one of the questions that a lot of our listeners give.
Well, fortunately, my job is a very flexible one in terms of time. I'm able to, you know, I'm in a position where I have a job that lets me work, you know, a solid 40 hours a week and not have to do crazy hours or anything. So it doesn't push into my time for other stuff. At the same time, you know, I've worked on Magic for a long time and I kind of know exactly the amount of time I need to spend on everything. Mm-hmm. And just knowing, you know, the limits of what I have to do for everything, being able to get it done is kind of, you know, let me balance my time and allocate what I'm doing. Also, I'm realizing I've hit my limits on a lot of stuff in terms of everything. So, you know, a lot of stuff, you know, this is basically what I do. I don't have, you know, I have a backlog of video games because I'm like, oh, when is the next time I get to play anything? Never? I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. But I like how you said that you know how much time is going to take you to put into Magic, for example. And that's what we want to dive into here is, you know, your history, what has led up to you being so comfortable and fluent with this game. And we love using stories. We love closing the gap between where you are and where we are with stories. And we want to hear your origins, I guess. The very first time you ever saw or played Magic the Gathering, when was that? What's that story?
So my cousin was babysitting me. I want to say it was probably like 1995, 1996. I distinctly remember the first card I ever saw was Arctic Foxes, nice. Which is inexplicably a creature that shows only one Pomeranian dog approximately in the art, it looks like. It has text regarding snow-covered lands, of which we had none at the time. So I played with my cousin when he babysat me. A little while later, I purchased some packs of, you know, Urza Saga and started playing, you know, 300-card deck casually. And then one day, I bought a Scry magazine, which was this, you know, pre-web pages, almost, you know, late 90s, before any, like, Magic news sites existed. Tournament results, all sorts of stuff. And I just, like, saw these tournament decks from around. It was Urza's Block, Mask Block, post after all the crazy things got banned, when Urza's Block was still super broken, and I just saw what these decks were doing, and I'm like, oh, wow, I should build some of these and play with them. And so I used cards I had, and I built a 10-land mono-green Stompy deck, played it at you know, local shops and was just started winning a bunch, played a local extended tournament, started playing that weekly, and then eventually a friend of mine I'd known for a while told me about this thing called the Junior Super Series, which was a scholarship tournament series they ran back then. And we tested a bunch and started playing standard for that. And around Onslaught, we just kind of jumped in, played a tournament. The first round I played was against my friend. We had coin flipped and seen who would play what deck. We had the two best decks in the format, one of which was a red-white control deck, one of which was a blue-green tempo deck. I got the tempo deck and lost to all of his Wrath of Gods and lost my top eight. And then from there, I just kind of kept playing those until they stopped running them and I was ineligible at the same time. Jumped into PTQs completely after that, quickly qualified for the Pro Tour, and then kind of was just on the Pro Tour since my first one.
Wow, that's incredible. What a great story. What a great journey. And that first set that you came in on, was that Ice Age? Because you said it had Arctic Fox and mentioned Snowcover Land. So did you come in on Ice Age?
Somewhere between Ice Age and Mirage, is if my memory serves me correctly.
So you've obviously been playing for a while. That's really neat. And what would you say in this whole journey of yours is your favorite set?
Oh, my favorite set, it's not even close, is Magic 2013. It's just, you know, constructive purposes, you can make cards from all sorts of different themes. War can be interesting. So, you know, I've played a lot of standard formats that have had very diverse metagames that have been very interesting for different reasons. But just the limited format, the draft of that was just, it's just with all these simple cards and all these simple effects, there's just so many different things that matter. Nothing's out of balance. All the colors are good. Every single deck, you're just kind of, there's so many little things in the format you're paying attention to every single draft that matter. You know, like, how do I beat a deck that's rancoring me? I can draft this, this, and this if I'm this color combination. You know, if I'm blue and black, I want to have this effect so I can beat this horde of creatures and then this effect so that I have a way to win the game. But if I don't find this effect, I can do this, this, and this. Hmm. And just like the depth of strategy, like the person who had the best record in our local Michigan drafts where I lived at the time in that format was just, they would just draft black and their strategy was just draw first and cast Mind Rot. And like, that was still a strategy you could plan for by, you know, choosing to draw first, choosing to, you know, play your cards in certain ways. And just like nothing was ever unbeatable in that format, despite some of the cards just appearing very strong. And just the strategy and depth of it is just astounding for how simple everything is.
Yeah, I love how you mentioned a core set for, you know, your favorite one. That's so neat. It's just neat to see the different perspective. And now I have, you know, a better understanding of how deep M13 was. So that is really, really cool. And before we get too far away from it, you mentioned that you picked up a Scry magazine. And I know that back in the day, there were a few Magic magazines, Scry and the Duelist and some others. And nowadays, as a content creator, because also nowadays, there are some niches that have like digital magazines. Do you think there's room for like a Magic digital magazine nowadays? Or do you think with Star City Games and Channel Fireball and all the other content creators that everything that could be offered is being offered?
I guess my question and response is what's the payoff for a magazine as opposed to like an article? You're getting, you know, certain formatting with like paper or whatever, but the rate that people can produce content now, I think it's better just to get all the content out there as opposed to some of the things that magazines are better for, which is, you know, like collating pages to make it, you know, look very nice. But in the time it takes to do that, and, you know, have an editor and other editors look over the pages and stuff. I know something about this process. My girlfriend actually works in a magazine right now. It's a long process. Instead of that, you could just have, you know, five different people's ideas just out there and talking about, you know, Magic, which is a very fast moving game, which means the information, you know, if you spend the time collating something to make it look as perfect as possible, the information might not be relevant by the time you put it out there.
Yeah, yeah. Because I've just been hearing like about digital magazines in other spaces, and I didn't know, yeah, if there was room for that in the Magic space. Because like you said, it's so fast paced that, and we already have all these articles. And so, you know, I was like, hey, talking to Ari, he's a content creator, might as well ask him.
I think the one thing that might be worth noting is that it might be useful to spend time to develop the tools to quickly present things in, you know, magazine styles. I'm a big fan of MTG Goldfish has a feature where you can just lay out a deck visually, and that kind of stuff that you might be able to adopt to make, you know, better visual representations on the fly. And you can make digital tools that just do that for you quickly.
Yeah, that is neat. That's cool. So, yeah, I love how there's still like angles and room to be, you know, explored even in the content creation space. So going back to favorites and firsts and whatnot, what is one of your favorite cards?
I think that the answer that has to be Vendilion Click. There's just this specific scenario with Vendilion Click that's just like one of the best feelings in competitive Magic I've ever, like, just over and over. Whenever you cast that card on your opponent's end step and then tell them to keep their hand, it's just, you know, you can judge how your opponent knows what's going on by how they look and react to it, because the people who are, you know, in the know are just like, oh, this is just over, and now I have to play through the fact that they can beat every card in my hand and then some. And then every so often you get someone who's like, my hand's a bunch of good cards, why'd they let me keep it? And they like are always, you know, even more disappointed at the end of it when they're like, I shouldn't have lost that. But like, just that feeling when you look at their hand and you're like, none of this matters. I'm just going to win this game five turns in advance. I guess the bonus answer is also Mind's Desire, because that card is just a blast to cast. Like, you just never know what's going to happen. I've won off Mind's Desire for 2. I've lost off Mind's Desire for 12. It's just like the perfect mix of power and gambling.
Nice. I like it. So we have had a few guests mention Vendilion Click, but no one's mentioned, is it Mind's Desire?
Mind's Desire.
Yeah. Tell us what that is. And
it's 4BB. You shuffle your deck, flip the top card, and you can cast that card until end of turn without paying its mana cost. And Mind's Desire has Storm. So it's the only card to have the distinction of being banned in a format before it was even released, because when Scourge, the set was in Scourge, the original set was Storm. When Scourge was spoiled, there was a bit of a delay between the set, you know, being released, like actually for sale, and the spoiler coming out. And in that time, people were building vintage Storm decks that would just kill on turn one, because you could cast, you know, 5 spells, Mind's Desire, hit cards like Time Twister and just win the game. So they restricted it in vintage, and I believe banned it in, I forget if it was called Legacy at the time, but they removed it from those formats, and it was banned in other formats. It was left in extended for a while, but it's been banned for a long time and just unplayable in anything but vintage for many years. So not a lot of people have a chance to play with it, but every time I play, you know, I play some vintage, And anytime I play that format, I just am like looking at the card. I'm like, I feel like I have to play this card just because of how fun it is when you cast it.
That, yeah, I've never heard of that. And I can just see, oh, yeah, like you said, the mix between power and gambling is just so so alluring. I can see that. That's great. That's really neat. And I mean, I can hear it. Everyone can hear it in your voice, how much you just love Magic and love the intricacies and things like that. And so what makes Magic fun for you? Like, what keeps you playing all these years and coming back for more?
It's just the constant puzzle that you're trying to figure out what you're supposed to do in Magic. And then even once you've already solved it, you know, once you play your deck at a tournament, suddenly all that new information just is, you're just starting over and all the pieces of the puzzle fall apart and you have to put it back together. So there's always, you know, something to be figuring out, new things, new pieces to put together. It's just a constantly fresh challenge.
A constantly fresh challenge. Love it. Absolutely love it. And everyone's journeys have ups and downs, highs and lows. And I want to dive into some of those with you and really pull out what you learned from some of those events. So what's been your worst Magic moment?
Worst. So I'm from originally Michigan, and there's this, from the time I started playing Magic was like the, you know, really competitive in like the mid 2000s. So there's this like stereotype of the better than you PTQ grinder that I think everyone kind of has some kind of grasp on. And that was, you know, super prevalent at the time. And I was kind of that way for a while. And at some point, I was playing in a PTQ for, it was actually for a Pro Tour I was actually already qualified for. And I was playing a standard Jund mirror match. My opponent boarded in a Cyborg card that was a Goblin Rune Blaster. It's two and a red for a 2/1 haste with kicker of a red to destroy a non-basic land. They had it in their deck on the draw, and in theory, that was just, you know, I knew that was too slow for the matchup, and I ended up, like, missing my land drop twice on the play after keeping, you know, a three-land hand, and my opponent plays it, and I'm just, like, why, like, yelling at my opponent after the match for, like, no reason, and then, you know, after it's done, I'm just like, what am I doing, you know, why do I care, you know, it's just, like, it's going to happen sometimes, you know, you keep a three-lander, you miss your land drop, and your opponent boards in a card that beats you, whatever. Getting mad about that's not going to change anything. You're just going to have to, you know, play on, win the next round. And that was kind of like this moment where it's just like being upset about it doesn't ever help you, especially if you get mad at your opponent, get mad at whatever. It's just, you know, there's not a lot you can do besides play the next match. It just, right. It play the next game.
Why do you think you cared so much? Especially because it was, you know, like you said, you were already qualified for the Pro Tour. Like,
I think at the time I kind of, I had spent a lot of time taking the side of, you know, Jund at the time was just really honestly just the best deck in Standard by miles. And people kept saying, you know, they beat it or whatever. And I kind of sculpted this at the time stand of like being the Jund master who was just, I'm going to beat everyone with this deck and I know it better than everyone. Except like the deck just, the mirror match was a coin flip no matter what you did. So I was playing it in these tournaments and I just felt like, I deserved to win because I could beat everyone except for I was playing a deck that was a coin flip against the mirror match. So in retrospect, you're going to play the mirror match, you know, as the most popular deck in the format. If it's 20% of the field or whatever, and you play a 10-round PTQ, you're going to play it a couple times. And, you know, some days you're just going to lose twice and that's just life. So I think at the time I was in a spot where I felt like I should be beating everyone. And I extended that to spots where I, you know, shouldn't be expecting that. And, you know, even if you assume you should beat everyone, you can't assume it every match. You know, sometimes the 90-10 matchup goes to the 10%.
Yeah. Just recently, I was having a conversation about just the mana system and how it's such a part of Magic and how it makes Magic so great. And one of the things that it does, because it does many things, one of the things that it does is that it gives hope, you know, to the newer players in the sense that anybody can sit down across a table from you or John Finkel or any of these great players and they have a chance to win because that could be the day that 10 lands in a row get lined up on the shuffle and that's all they draw and you win, you know? And so that's, and like you said, it happens to everybody. And another thing I want to bring up, one of the reasons why I think that we care so much is because there is a piece of us, I feel like, in our decks. You know, like we put it together. Even nowadays when we, you know, net deck and things like that and pulling other people's deck lists, we still went through the time to, like, determine that this deck resonates with us. We put it together and we're sitting down and we're playing. And so there's, I feel, a piece of us, like, in the game. And when we lose, the people who aren't able to really kind of separate the game from self, you know, take it harder than, you know, than those who have mastered that skill and say, hey, it happens to everybody and can move on to the next one. And so it's hard to take sometimes.
Yeah. Plus, you know, at the time, at the exact moment, you know, it feels often, it feels good to just be mad or just be like
to vent.
And, you know, I've definitely recently, you know, I've had events where I've just, I'm thinking there was a Grand Prix Atlanta recently where it was Battle for Zendikar draft, and I like drafted green on day two and just made a couple mistakes in the draft and lost because of it. And after the tournament, I was like, just kind of venting to a friend, and I was kind of smiling about it and made the comment of like, I know right now I'm just venting because I would like to enjoy venting and it doesn't hurt me to do so, which in turn is funny and enjoyable of itself because I know I'm just like doing this behavior that's completely not helpful because I think it's helpful.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Oh man. Good stuff. So on the flip side of that coin are the ups, and what's been your proudest Magic moment to date?
I know a lot of people would assume that it was winning a pro tour, but actually I'd have to say it was the friend of mine who introduced me to competitive Magic, who got me into the JSS, you know, moved away from Magic for a while, but every so often would come back for a major event. And there was a pro tour in Japan that I was at, and he messaged me. He's like, I happen to be, you know, studying abroad in Japan, so I'm going to come down to the pro tour. And this was actually the last ever Pro Tour where they had a last chance qualifier. So the day before the Pro Tour, they used to run last chance qualifiers, which were just open events. Any number of people sign up. It's Swiss rounds plus one. So, you know, if 200 people sign up, it's, you know, like a 10 round event, and the top four qualify for the Pro Tour.
Wow.
And at the time, it was a standard tournament, and it was when Stoneforge Mystic and Batterskull were legal and standard. And he's asking me, like, what should I play? And I'm like, I have the best deck in the format. It is absolutely absurd. And it was the Splinter Twin combo version of the deck. And I handed him the deck. I explained everything to him. And he qualified for his first Pro Tour and ended up playing. And I was like, I don't know. It was just kind of one of those really great moments. Like, this is the person that got me into competitive Magic. At the time, I'm, like, playing on the Pro Tour. And this is a big thing I can do. And, like, I happened to be able to help them make it to the Pro Tour. That was great.
Wow, that's neat. And I love how your proudest moment revolved around, you know, somebody else. And there's nothing wrong with the other people who, you know, won a GP and that's their proudest moment, things like that. I just love how, you know, that you're cognizant of that and you recognize that this person got you into competitive Magic and it felt really good to return the favor, not necessarily get him into competitive Magic, but get him to the highest tournament in competitive Magic and to see him do well. That's awesome.
I'm going to be honest, like, you know, I've done the tournament winning thing a couple times and I've never felt like, you know, the immediate payoff of like I won, because I think it was there was a Jerry Thompson article where he talks about, you know, winning Grand Prix and then he like gets the trophy and he's just kind of sitting there like, wait, where's my next opponent? Cause you know, if you're running through these tournaments and you're like in this mindset of playing all these games, you just reach this end point and you're like, wait, they just stopped giving me more games to play. What do I do now? And they're just kind of like handing you a trophy and you're just like, what am I doing? And it's kind of switching modes there is kind of surreal. But, you know, when you're on the sidelines watching a friend, you are completely invested in them winning, not them making the right play, you know, them winning. So when they win, that's just, you know, you've hit the goal.
Nice. Oh, that's so cool. That is really cool. And on this journey as well, what has been the deepest thing you've learned about yourself from playing Magic?
In terms of myself, it's kind of interesting because, you know, I mentioned I've been, you know, with my girlfriend for 10 years. I've been playing competitive Magic for 15 years. I've basically, you know, my career path is something I kind of figured out pretty early on and just went to college for engineering, went through, liked what I did. And it's kind of been the realization has kind of been, you know, I guess I've been lucky to find things that I like that I've been rewarded for pursuing, but it's kind of, you know, if I enjoy doing something and I clearly have an upside to continue doing it, I don't know if it's going to get worse. My realization has just kind of been like, I'm going to keep doing it until it gets worse. And then if it doesn't, that's great. You know, obviously if there's, you know, a clear downside to I've skipped pro tours for school or whatever. It's like, well, I kind of have to, you know, do this final presentation for my degree or whatever, instead of go to this pro tour. You know, you can obviously weigh the downside there, but it's kind of just like, well, you know, sometimes others, it's like, you know, I would like to go to this pro tour and I have, you know, something going on at the time. It's like, well, you know, I would like to do this and it's upside for me to keep going to the pro tour. And, you know, I could probably just make it work. And, you know, I worked towards it and made it happen. It's kind of, I'm trying to figure out like the whole tie together here of just like, I guess the end statement is that, you know, I've kind of reached this point of just like, if things are going well and you can keep them going well, questioning the whole process that got you there, if you can see them going well in the future, it's probably just good to just, you know, keep enjoying what you're doing and just enjoy what's going on.
So with that in mind, looking forward, yeah, what's in store for you? What's in store for you in the future? Do you see the Hall of Fame in your future, or are you going to stick around Magic that long? Is that even a thing for you, or what are your thoughts?
I'm not really quite close in terms of results, I guess, but I don't see, you know, like I was saying, I don't see a reason for me to stop playing competitive Magic anytime in the future.
Yeah.
You know, I'm currently in the process of figuring out moving to Washington, D.C. from Massachusetts to, you know, my girlfriend has a job out there, but just kind of, you know, looking at it as, you know, I'll find something that lets me keep playing competitive Magic there because I should be able to do that. And I plan on continuing playing until, I don't know, someone tells me to stop.
until the downside of playing, if any, outweighs the upside of not. So yeah, yeah. I hear you. Are you a platinum pro? Are you platinum level right now?
I am currently through the end of this year. I probably won't be for the following season, barring a top eight at Pro Tour Sydney. You know, I'm sitting just at hitting gold for the next season, which is a pretty big gap from platinum right now.
Yeah. What is it? 36 to 50? Is that the gap?
33 to 50. So
33 to 50. Okay.
I'm sitting at 31. So I actually, you know, even if I pick up a point or two from the next few Grand Prix I go to, I still need to top eight the Pro Tour to hit platinum.
Wow. How many points do you get for top eighting a Pro Tour?
18.
Oh, wow. I did not know it was that many. That's incredible.
Yeah. Holy smokes. It's 18 plus 4 per win in the top eight, which is just massive amounts. Smokes.
Wow. I didn't realize it was that much. Cool.
Yeah.
And you said as far as Hall of Fame, you're not quite there on results. Now, are there like hard results? Because I know that there's also like, you know, just kind of the soft, is this person good as a whole for the Magic community? But they also look at Pro Tour top eights. Is that right?
They do. So the hard number is generally, if you have four top eights with a win, you are very close to or around consideration. You know, the people who have four top eights and a win who aren't really considered aren't people who have had big public personas outside the Pro Tour. The other thing too is that, you know, I'm sitting on a win. So if you, there's one person in all of Magic who has two Pro Tour wins who isn't in the Hall of Fame. And the joke is that they were Kai Bud's teammate on two of the Pro Tours that Kai won that were team Pro Tours.
Oh, snap. Who is it?
I believe Marco Bloom. Is that correct?
Wow, that's neat. So he won two Pro Tours, but both of them were team ones. So he won with
both
Kai?
Both of them were team limited with Kai as his teammate.
Got it. Well, that's neat. I mean, definitely wish you the best of luck. And that's,
yeah.
Oh man, like I mean, 18 plus four. Like I didn't even realize that. That's really incredible. And I hope you clinch that for the next season for sure. That'd be sweet.
That'd be very nice to do so. I definitely like these limited formats that are coming up. So, you know, the Innistrad block limited is really up my alley. So I'm hoping that if the next format's similar to this, I feel like with a good constructed deck, I have a good chance of making it all the way there.
So you obviously weren't always crushing GPs and winning Pro Tours and things like that. So you started somewhere just like all of us. What was an aspect of Magic that you were terrible at when you first started that you eventually overcame? Can you pinpoint something that you can share with us so that we can hone our skills?
Yeah. So back when I started playing Magic, the first standard format and a half or so that I played was just so wide open that there was never really a best deck. So I, you know, would select a deck and that I liked and I'd play it and I'd do fine because every deck was similar. But then they printed a set called Darksteel. They printed a card called Skullclamp, which is another one of these cards that has been basically banned out of existence. It's a one mana artifact. It's an equipment. The equipped creature gets +1/-1, and when an equipped creature dies, you draw two cards. It costs one to equip. And to put things in context, the effect was basically you'd pay one mana and sacrifice a creature to draw a card. And this was so powerful, or draw two cards, sorry. This was so powerful that every single deck in the format became a deck full of one toughness creatures and Skull Clamp. There was a ramp combo deck at the time that became a elf ramp combo deck because playing elves that drew two cards was better than playing actual ramp spells. So when this happened, I was just like, oh, you know, I can beat the Skull Clamp decks with all the cards that look like they can beat Skull Clamp. And I just didn't. And I just never played Skull Clamp in a sanctioned tournament, and I lost a decent amount. And similarly, you know, over the next couple of years, there would just be times where there was a clear best deck, and I would keep myself from playing it because I'm just like, oh, I can beat it because that's what you're just supposed to do, is you're supposed to try to beat the best deck. And at some point, I think it took me all the way to Lorwyn and Fairies. Because I remember playing there was two seasons where you could play the Fairies deck with, you know, Bitter Blossom, Spellstutter Sprite, and it was this crazy tempo control counterspell deck, and it just beat everything. And for the entire first season, I didn't play it because I played a different deck. And at some point in the second season, I was just, you know, hit this point where I was just like, I should just play all these good cards. Why did I never do this in a format? And that was kind of like a breakthrough moment for me where I was just, you know, when there's a best deck, your goal isn't to beat it 100%. It's to determine if you can beat it, but at the same time, also figure out all the ways that people are trying to beat it and then see if it can just beat those anyways. Because sometimes just playing the best builds of the best deck is just 100% correct rather than trying to be the person going to the next level. Because sometimes there just isn't one. A great example recently is Grand Prix Houston that Owen Turtenwald won earlier this year, where everyone was trying all these crazy things. They had these like mono colorless ramp decks. They had these hardened scaled decks, and they're doing all these things. And then Owen just beats them all with Rally the Ancestors and Reflector Mage, which was the best deck coming into the tournament. It's not like it got any better. Everyone knew exactly what he was doing. And his cards were just so much better than everyone else's that if he played them well, which he did, he was just going to beat them. And yeah, he just won the tournament relatively easily in the matches that we watched.
I love that because I've fallen into that. Oh, I don't want to play the best deck because everyone's playing and I want to be that other guy, you know? So what was it? So you mentioned you just kind of went click and, oh, I should be playing with this, but was there anything, is there another layer there? Like what was it that took you from being anti-best deck to, hey, like this is just the best. Like if you want to be competitive, this is what you should do.
There were 10 games played in the back room of RAW Hobbies. This was the Pro Tour. This was me testing for my first ever Pro Tour, the Pro Tour that Gabe Nassif ended up winning with Cruel Ultimatum Control, which is this five-color control deck. So Patrick Chapin had his list of that deck, which was a known deck, one of the good decks, and I tested against him because, you know, we played at the same store, and he beat me five games in a row despite my deck having its best possible draw that should always beat the control deck. I played against another friend of mine, Kyle Bogomis, who has a few, you know, Pro Tour 2nd, a Pro Tour 9th, and he was playing the Fairies deck, and he beat me four games in a row despite me having great draws. And it was just a moment where I'm just like, my deck did everything it should, and their cards were just better than mine. And I, you know, I had spent the whole season playing the deck and beating people who were, you know, playing those decks a little worse, maybe, you know, keeping a little worse hands or whatever. And like, it was just a moment where it was just like, oh, a good player with the best deck is just going to beat you more than you ever thought they would.
Gabe's awesome. He was back on episode 75 here on MTG Pro Tutor, and he's just a really good guy. So just want to throw that out there. I think it's really neat that you have been able to rub shoulders and play with some really great players. And I love how you said, just because you're winning against the best deck, you also have to take into consideration who's piloting it. Because if you're winning against somebody who saw the best deck, they threw it together, and they're not the best player, then yeah, you have an edge on them because of your play skill. But that doesn't mean that when you show up to a competitive level event, like a Grand Prix or, you know, a qualifier or the Pro Tour, that the people that you run into there are going to be of that same level. They're actually going to be better because otherwise they wouldn't be at that big event. And so you have to take that into consideration as well. I think that's very eye-opening. I think that's very good. So did you jump on the Eldrazi train when that was around a few months ago for Modern?
In the Pro Tour, I played Abzan Company because our Eldrazi lists weren't quite as impressive as the ones that showcased the Pro Tour. And the deck was fine. And after the Pro Tour, I'm like, well, this, you know, has a decent Eldrazi matchup and this, and this. And then I just kind of like looked at everything. I'm just like, I can't convince myself to play anything. So I played Blue-White Eldrazi at the one Grand Prix I played of that format. And I, you know, I lost three matches at that tournament. Beat a bunch of people who weren't playing Eldrazi, and I just lost two mirror matches, and I lost once to Company. And it was just very clearly correct to do.
Was it Ralph?
It was not Ralph. I forget my opponent's name. I believe they beat David Ochoa the previous round, and they beat me that round. Both of us playing Blue White Eldrazi.
So I bet they're feeling pretty good about themselves. Yeah. Obviously, I remember that because Ralph Patesh won, not running a Eldrazi deck, and the other two Grand Prix that weekend were run by Eldrazi. And at the time, I was like, yeah, go Ralph. Woo! And then I thought, a friend of mine pointing this out, is like, it would have been cool if we could say that there was a time that three Grand Prix on three different continents were won by the same, you know, the same type of deck. It just would have been like a neat stamp on history. But
yeah,
alas, not to take away from Ralph at all, we had him on the show as well. And he's just a good player as well. And so it actually inspired me to, right now I'm playing Bogles in Modern because I'm rather new and I need something pretty linear. But I do love the idea of like a toolbox type deck. And so I do want to build out that an Abzan deck for Modern and just get better at that because I just like that idea.
So, interestingly, Bogles just got a card that could make it towards a toolbox deck in Open the Armory.
Really?
I'm not sure. I haven't tested it or anything, but I think that there are spots where you are willing to pay 3 mana for a Spirit Link or an Ethereal Armor or a Rancor just because of the unique effect. So, it's possible that that card is actually playable in the deck.
Interesting. Because, I would imagine that you know, you wouldn't have time to fetch stuff up. You need to be playing stuff and swinging in as opposed to taking off a turn just to, you know, go fetch a piece. But you're saying the ability to look for what I need specifically.
Yeah. Well, also, I think the other card that might actually show up in that deck is Griffspoon.
Really? Because it's recurability.
Well, it's also just a cheap enchantment that gives you plus power and flying. You know, there's not really an enchantment that has a similar plus power plus evasion effect.
That's true. That's true. Because right now, obviously, the Umbras give me reach and like first strike or whatever, but not evasion. You're right. So I can block evasion, but I don't get evasion. Oh, okay. Oh, I might spice up my spice up my deck a little bit. Oh, because Grand Prix LA is coming up in May, and it's Modern, so that's why I've been testing out my Bogles deck. So we'll see how that goes. Cool, right on, excellent. Thanks so much for sharing that. I think that it takes a lot of oneself to make that realization. I'm prodigies. I hope you're listening. That you know, there's nothing wrong. You're not selling out if you play the best deck. If you've gone through the exercise of recognizing what the best deck is, and if you even gone through the steps of trying to beat it. And that deck is still winning, then, hey, there's a little bit of truth to if you can't beat them, join them. You know, just sleeve it up and go have a good time. And I know a lot of people who they said, hey, you know what? I know Eldrazi is the best deck. I know it's not going to last for a long time. So I'm just going to play the heck out of it because we're not going to be able to play this deck, as it exists now forever because they're going to ban something. Sure enough, they banned something. And, you know, everybody who got to play the deck got to enjoy that little piece of Magic history. So anyways, do you have a pretty sweet collection already? Do you have any, I don't know, Power 9 or something, just, you know, Black Lotus or something expensive that you keep locked up in a box?
After I got my first job out of college, first thing I saved up for and got dealt with was, you know, loans and stuff. But immediately after that, the next thing I did was save up and get Power 9. So
nice. Very nice. Now, when someone says they have Power 9, does that mean they have one of each or like a play set of each? Or what is that? What does
just, that just one of each. A play set of each. I don't even want to think about how many. Yeah, that's probably like the flashiest, coolest thing. But the one I like the most is probably I have a back in the day, the card Morphling was considered the best creature of all time. It's a 3 blue for a 3/3. And you can pay 1 to give it, you know, +1/-1 or -1/+1 until end of turn. You can pay blue to untap it, blue to give it flying, and blue to give it shroud until end of turn. And so it was just this unkillable control threat. So I had one at the time, and I got it signed by the artist, RK Post, who comes around to a lot of Magic events still. Great guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I got it signed by Richard Garfield, the creator of the game. And they both altered the art on it a bit. So it's kind of this unique, you know, double sign thing that represents like an era of Magic long past for me because Morphling's been eclipsed by so many creatures since then. But I have it as kind of like a memories of, you know, the first deck that I really started playing sanctioned tournaments with was like a mono blue control deck, and it had that exact card in it.
Where and how did you meet Richard Garfield?
Richard Garfield used to show up to a few Magic events. I think he was at a U.S. Nationals where they held the Junior Super Series Championships one year.
And like you said, RK Post goes to a lot of, especially North American events. I was at GP, I think it was Vegas, the first Grand Prix I went to last year. And there's people running around, they're getting tokens and they're showing, you know, I mean, I'm in line to get stuff signed. And I'm like, oh, I'm not a tokens guy. Like, you know what? That's cool that you're doing tokens, but whatever. And then I'm in line, RK Post line for the first time to go get something signed. I look over and I see a Boba Fett 1-1 white warrior token. And I'm like, oh, or soldier, excuse me, 1-1 white soldier token. I was like, oh my gosh, I love Boba Fett. And I play, you know, Elsbeth, obviously, who didn't. And so she makes soldiers. And so I had to pick those up. And thus started my, I guess, love of RK Post tokens. And so now I pick up a few every single GP I go to and get them signed. And like you said, he's just a great guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy who does great work. You know, I love his art. I love his style. You know, I love his personality that kind of shows through in him showing up to events and what he puts out there and everything. So,
yeah, love it. So bringing things to current times, Ari, what would you say is your best or your favorite format?
I think I enjoy playing vintage the most. Unfortunately, it's not really a format that's accessible. Like over the past few years, it's really started to incorporate the best parts of what's really, you know, new Magic with creatures and tempo and things like that being dominant. And the best parts of old Magic, which are a lot about, there's two spells in your opponent's deck that matter that are going to break open the game. And you have to position and plan to fight over those spells. So it's really got this nice mix going on now. In terms of formats that are more accessible, right now I am just loving Shadows Over Innistrad Draft. It is a format that rewards you for having a vision of what you want your deck to do and building for it, but at the same time being willing to see something and then all of a sudden adjust everything you're doing. You know, if you look at in the format, you can draft, you know, a bunch of different blue-red decks. So you can be like a blue-red Rise from the Tides deck. But that doesn't mean that, you know, there's control versions of that that are just, you know, a lot of removal and everything. There's, you know, very aggressively self-milling versions of that with like pieces of the puzzle. There's aggressive versions of it that are, you know, playing Nibilis of Dusk, which is the 2-1 Prowess Flyer, and combining that with Rush of Adrenaline and Uncaged Fury as this kind of double strike pump combo. It's got this like really nice position of you have to build something that's more than the parts that, you know, put it together. But at the same time, there's a lot of flexibility. It's not just like in some formats, you know, the format that everyone really likes is Rise of the Eldrazi. But my problem with that format was like you would draft a leveler's deck and every leveler's deck was doing the exact same thing, which was, you know, play creatures with the level up mechanic and then play the creature that leveled them up or whatever. Whereas in this format, you know, there's a lot more flexibility because the cards don't, you know, there's not like a linear mechanic behind a lot of the cards. They don't entirely tell you what to do. So you could be drafting a Delirium deck in your pod, and it could look totally different from someone else's Delirium deck because you are trying to get the zero cards in deck in Epitaph Golem, whereas they are just trying to hit Delirium so that their Moldgrass Scavengers and Paranoid Parish Blades get pumped. And that kind of, you know, flexibility is just really awesome. The format's not as deep on it as the original Innistrad, but in return, it's a little more like a normal limited game of Magic than the original Innistrad.
Oh, I love it. I love how you laid that out. And you actually got me really excited because I'm not able to do limited right now as much as I want. However, I am dedicated to making my first cube, and it's going to be Shadows Over Innistrad. And eventually I'll mix in some of the older Innistrad, but at least with the cube, I'll be able to eventually dive in and experience, you know, a lot more in depth some of these things that you're bringing out now. So very, very exciting. Thank you for sharing. So to get some nitty gritty, like meat and potatoes type stuff from you, us prodigies, we love Magic. And, you know, we go to Friday Night Magic. We go to Grand Prix when they're closed. And we really want to do well because, you know, we understand that going to play Magic sometimes means we're taking time and resources away from, you know, family or other hobbies, things like that. And so while we don't expect to win every time, because that's unreasonable, we do want to learn every time. And so what is the biggest mistake that you see players make? And then how can we avoid that mistake?
I think the biggest mistake that players routinely make is assuming that, you know, is basically logicking from the end. So they see that they make a decision and then something happens and then they go backwards and they're like, well, this and this, and, you know, this and this. You know, this results in times where they think like, oh, well, you know, from the spot I was in, I could have done this, this, and this to beat these three exact cards. And, you know, maybe you shouldn't have actually, you know, from the start, like, you were right to not play around all that. Or you can end up in a spot where you logic your way through and there's, you know, you're like, well, there was nothing I can do based on this, this, and this. But if you look at it from the front side, you're actually convincing yourself of something that wasn't true. You know, you look at a spot, you know, four turns before that you didn't actually think about that, like, maybe you could have just gotten a free attack in or something. And people, they view the game, you know, I definitely err a little too far on this side where they try to derive information from the end of the game. And instead of making decisions on the spot based on what they have and the information they have and learning from those kinds of decisions. And there's definitely a time and place to, you know, if you walk into a combat trick or something, you just, it's easy to just, oh, well, I shouldn't have done that. And then you never do it again. But a lot of times people try too hard to use what actually happened as a predictor of what they should do in the future in, you know, similar spots, as opposed to just kind of looking at the scenario as a whole and saying, well, there's possibilities that could have happened that didn't. And those are things you also have to consider.
I like that because oftentimes we've heard, hey, you know, at the end of each game, you need to evaluate post-game evaluation, right? Figure out, even if you won, figure out what you could have done better. And so oftentimes I'll find a turn, hey, here on this turn, I did this and when I should have done that. But you're saying that in that, I have to be cognizant of in that situation with the information that I had at the time that maybe I did make the right play anyways and not kind of talk myself out of it.
Not talk yourself out of it, or, you know, think about with the information that you had at the time, mm-hmm. you know, let's say you attack, you look at the board and you're like, well, if my opponent has this removal spell, I lose if I attack, but I'm going to do it. And then you attack, you got to look back at the board at the time and say, well, did my opponent have a play pattern that indicated that maybe they did have that removal spell? You know, imagine, you know, they've left up four mana for the last four turns and you attack and you get Silver Striked, which is the four mana destroy attacking creature, gain three life. You can say then, oh, well, yes, at the time I had seen them leave up four mana for a bunch of turns. Or, you know, they've made a bunch of attacks in a row that indicated that they had a +2/+2 combat trick. And then I made a play that lost a +2/+2 combat trick. Huh. But, you know, if your opponent's just tapped out every turn and then one turn they like have one card in hand that they've drawn for the turn and they like make a normal attack and you attack back and they have the removal spell.
Got it.
There, you know, maybe you could have played around it just based on, you know, your cards and there was like, oh, you missed a line that played around it. But sometimes you just have to accept that, you know, that's just what's going to happen.
Yeah. Cool, man. Very cool. Wow. So we have covered a lot of ground and I have time's just been flying and I love chatting with you. So thanks so much for sharing. Just have a few more things before we wrap up. When you are going to bigger events, let's say, you know, like a Grand Prix or Pro Tour, things like that, what do you do to prepare? Like, what does, you know, like, what does the week look like? Like, what does a effective play session look like? Give us an insight into that, preparing for a big event.
So I usually, you know, that's one of the things I mentioned, you know, full-time job, girlfriend, everything. So I try to start early and space out my preparation as much as possible, you know, maximize the amount of time I have. And I definitely like it. Or, I mean, I sometimes do despite my best trying to, but I don't like playing, you know, if I have to play standard one weekend, modern the next weekend, limited the next weekend, I just know one of those formats is going to fall by the wayside. There's no way to, you know, prep for that many formats that fast with the time I have. So I'll start early. There's usually information about where the format is. And I start with, I pick a spot that looks good on paper. So if everyone is playing fast, aggressive decks, I'll look and say, well, let's, you know, pick a deck that has sweepers and I'll start there. And I'll try to get a broad section of playing against everything. So Magic Online is really good for this. I just kind of play against people who just show up with what they're going to play because they're playing a tournament. They're going to play what they want to play in a tournament. So I'll play against them and I'll notice some things. And then from there, I'll take the next step of, you know, well, I noticed this, this, and this were ineffective in this deck, or, you know, sweepers aren't actually effective against the aggressive decks. So I'll try this. And then over the course of, you know, this is for like a Grand Prix, which Pro Tours are their own unique, absurd challenge of brand new format and very difficult and completely different and hard to really describe without, you know, a huge deep dive into that. But okay. For like a Grand Prix, you have all this information. So you can take these steps and say, okay, I noticed this, this, and this. And then, you know, you play another few matches with a different deck or something. and you say, well, this and this worked, this and this didn't, but I noticed my opponent was doing this, so I want to try that. And then eventually over time, you just kind of iterate and iterate to the point where you're like, well, I've seen people doing these things. This is what I've seen be effective. This is what I've seen be ineffective. And you also get this feel of like where people are even moving. So when you start testing, people are on aggressive decks, but you notice that everyone has started picking up, you know, the mid-range creature deck as a counter. So you can say, well, I know a lot of people are going to show up to this Grand Prix with the deck everyone's expecting. I also know a lot of people are going to show up with this deck that everyone is expecting a little less, but is going to beat that. And you have a very good, you know, this sort of iterated testing against an open field gives you this really good idea of what you can expect to play against, what things are actually effective. Just general, some sideboard things. You just play a lot of sideboarded games and figure out, you know, well, I boarded out too many creatures. My deck no longer works or whatever. So I really, that's just how I approach testing for any open field event. And it's been the most successful, you know, even not online, just local stores playing back when I, you know, in Michigan, we had a great competitive scene and I would test my decks, you know, just at local tournaments over and over and play against a spread of the field. And then if I'm missing anything, I just sit down and say, I would like to play, you know, five matches against this and find, you know, a friend who's willing to test and you can fill in the gaps, you know, because you just know you've, you know, you haven't played against the blue control deck or whatever. You can play your games against it and figure out what works.
So I was going to ask, how many matches does it take? Like, for example, you go with sweepers and you start there because the aggro deck is prevalent. And you play some matches and realize, oh, the sweepers aren't doing that well as I thought. How many matches does that take? I know it's different per format, stuff like that. But just generally speaking, is it like, you know, after 3, 5, 10, 20, like how long does it take for you to say, hey, this strategy isn't working and tweak it? Because like you said, you don't have unlimited time before the Grand Prix comes. You have to do your iterations in some reasonable amount of time so you can show up with the deck that you're comfortable with.
I do these things really fast because I think that one of my strengths in Magic is pattern recognition. So I like,
okay,
cool. You know, I've played a lot of Magic over a lot of years. I can just see, you know, this game went this way. That looks like a typical game that's going to play out. So I was testing for, this is being recorded the weekend before a quarterly Magic Online Championship Series event, testing Standard. I stopped with a deck 2 matches in because I just saw like what was going on and just knew it was terrible. But at this, you know, if the deck is winning and I can't put my finger on what's wrong with it, I'll start playing, you know, 10, 15, 20 matches. And the goal is that if you just can't figure out what's wrong with the deck, you just never stop playing it until the tournament starts.
Got it. Okay, cool. I like that. So, yeah, if there's something glaringly obvious, you just jump ship and find something else quickly so you can utilize your test time. But then if you come across something that's good, you just stick with it.
Yeah, and there's definitely traps you can fall into here with, like, if you are trying something that's new and underdeveloped, it's easy to throw it away too soon because you play some games and it's bad. So the thing you have to be looking out for in those cases, and this is kind of branching into how you test for a new format, how you test for a pro tour, is you test versus a lot of things with decks. And the thing you are looking for with anything that isn't tuned isn't how well it does, but how well specific interactions perform. So you might notice that the combination of Kalidus and Radiant Flames is very, very good. And you want to try it. You know, you had a Grixis deck that was bad, but whenever you played those two cards, you won a lot. So you can try putting other cards that are good. And you know from like a different testing session that, you know, Declaration and Stone is good. So those all come together or something.
Got it. Yeah. So again, not the specific results that you had against a certain matchup, but interactions both among your cards and among cards, you know, yours versus your opponent's cards. And so then you can, okay, got it. That's neat. And then after that, so then once you've kind of identified some of those and you build that out a little bit, then you start worrying about the specific results and how well, you know, that deck is doing. Is that right?
Specific results, sideboarding, what you need to shore up, what you can afford to skimp on.
Oh, love it. And so real quick, what do you take with you? What's actually in your tournament bag when you go to an event?
It depends on the tournament. It ranges from me bringing pretty much all of Modern to a tournament. If I'm, you know, like the Modern Pro Tour where I was still determining what I was going to play, I had to bring basically the entire format, which I fortunately own a lot of. To there was a Legacy Grand Prix in Seattle recently, where I showed up with nothing because I was borrowing a deck from a friend and they had the whole deck for me and I knew it was exactly what I wanted to play.
All right. And then as far as non-card stuff, do you just show it with your cards and that's it or do you have other stuff?
I've got like a preset backpack that I leave, you know, I've started leaving more dice than I should in there. Like a play mat is very useful for Grand Prix if they're not going to hand one out to me on site. Often for Grand Prix, I will pack a single bag with clothes and cards and then unpack at the hotel when I get there. I'm definitely on the traveling compact side of things. Not necessarily light, but I like to shove everything into one backpack that looks like it's going to explode.
Nice. So you got your deck, you got play mat, some dice, and yeah, travel compact. Nice. Good stuff.
Water bottle. Very important.
Whew, good stuff. All right. So thank you so much. Once again, all you prodigies, if you want to connect with Ari, the best place to do that is on Twitter. He's at ARMLX. So look him up there. And then also, obviously, you can find his articles on the premium side of Star City Games. So if you're into that, then go check it out. He has obviously a lot of good insights to share about Magic. Ari, what is one last parting piece of guidance that you have for us? Either something that you've already said you want to emphasize or something new that you want to leave with us here at the end.
First and foremost, you know, I've talked a lot about being very competitive at the game because that's what I enjoy. But at the end of the day, it's still a game. You should still be having fun with what you're doing. And if you aren't enjoying how you're approaching the game, just stop and consider like what you can do about that. That doesn't mean you have to completely change everything you're doing, but, you know, just figure out why you're not enjoying what you're doing and then fix that. Stop doing the things you don't enjoy. Start doing the things you actually enjoy doing and just actually have fun with it.
Ari, I want to acknowledge you for your contributions to the multiverse. And thank you so much for your time and for sharing your expertise. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it's been a blast chatting with you. May you always draw what you need and depart every plane victorious.
Thanks. Been great to be here.
Wow. Ari, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your expertise. I loved it. Prodigies out there, you didn't hear it because after we recorded, we chatted for a little bit longer in a post-interview chat, and he shared some really cool, like, modern tips and tech with me for my Slippery Bogles deck. So he was just a really generous guy. Totally loves Magic, willing to talk about it. We could have gone on forever. Definitely one of the players that I would love to have on again someday. He was absolutely great. So Ari, thank you so much. Prodigies, as always, you can find the show notes at mtgprotutor.com/ArieLax. So go over there to get a quick synopsis of everything that we talked about and links to the resources that he mentioned. To wrap things up, I do want to remind you that I have a free video training series. It goes over sideboarding, mindset, deck building, things like that. LevelUpYourSkill.com is where you can go to find that. A free video training series, LevelUpYourSkill.com. I'm basically compiling all the tips that I've gathered from these amazing players and trying to put it all in one easy-to-find place. And LevelUpYourSkill.com is the first step to that. So that's really it for today. Thank you so much for joining me. There's a lot of fun stuff going on here in Magic. I'm super pumped because we have a lot of Grand Prix coming up. In particular, at the end of the month of May, we have Grand Prix LA, which I will be at. If you're going to be there, please let me know. I would love to do some kind of Prodigy meetup or hangout or something where we can get together and maybe play some Magic, at least take a picture, high five, something. We can get together. Any Prodigy who's going to be at GPLA, I'd be happy to connect with you and say hi. So a lot of fun stuff. Stay in touch. I look forward to connecting with you more. I'm Sean Penrod, and we'll see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.